You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Ron.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay. And how are you?
I'm doing fine. Doing great. It's a beautiful day here in Arlington, Virginia.
So. In Arlington, Virginia. Yeah. Are the cherry blossoms out yet? No.
They're coming late this year because it was such a difficult winter. It was a very weird winter. But so I think they're coming next month, but not yet.
Okay. Well, let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Ron Campius, a return guest. And you know a lot about the stuff we're going to talk about today, which is Iran war related, as I'll explain. You were, until your recent retirement, Washington Bureau Chief of the JTA News Gathering Organization, which, as its full name, Jewish Telegraphic Agency, suggests, has been around for a long, long time, longer even than you and me. But you've been around long enough to know a lot about this stuff. You were you worked for Associated Press. You worked for the Jerusalem Post. You've been in bureaus in New York, in Jerusalem, in London, and again in Washington. And so what I want to talk about today is the Iran war and various of its consequences, including its effect on U.S. Israeli relations. There have, of course, for some time been people in the United States who would like to see more distance between the U.S. and Israel policy-wise, and not just people on the left. Increasingly, there's a group within MAGA that would like to see that. Of course, most recently and famously, this guy Joe Kent, who had been appointed by Trump to be head of the National Counterterrorism Center, resigned, and in his resignation letter said that Israel had dragged us into this war and suggested that it had dragged us into the Iraq War of 2003. And of course, there are people who say, well, saying those kinds of things will foment anti-Semitism. There are people who say saying those kinds of things is anti-Semitic. At the same time, there are people, you know, we had Peter Beinart on recently, who leaving that question aside, would say that some of Netanyahu's policies are predictably adversely affecting the safety of Jews around the world, and so on. So there's a lot here to discuss. Maybe I'll just start by asking you if you have any reaction to what I've said, or for that matter, you want to say anything about the war itself. You know, we're in this phase where Trump backed off of this threat to obliterate power centers in Iran if it didn't open the Strait of Hormuz, or said to be some kind of indirect negotiations may be going on. So he's extended the deadline for a few days. That's where we are in the war. Anyway, anything you want to say about any of this?
No, I mean, I get it. That's a really good outline of where we are. I think, you know, I read a transcript of Peter's video the other day, and he got it right. I mean, in the sense that Emmanuel Jakubowicz, so this is what I always come back to, because I guess I was a young adult at the time and it was interesting and I was paying attention. He was the chief rabbi of Britain. He was Thatcher's rabbi. So he was like politically conservative. She famously preferred his counsel to that of the Anglican Church on a lot of issues. And he would constantly say that the state of Israel needs to take into account the effect that its actions have on Jews in the diaspora, not because of the Jews in the diaspora should necessarily be identified with the state of Israel. They shouldn't, but because in the same sense that, you know, any country like starting a war or starting a military action, if they've got civilians living on the border, they have to, let's say, you know, and Israel does this as well. It's done, it's had, at times it's gone to war in Lebanon, at times it's refrained from war in Lebanon because it takes into, its calculus includes the effect on the lives of the civilians on the border. You can say that Hezbollah are bad actors, terrible actors. You can say that going to war is entirely Hezbollah's fault, but you also take into account what effect it's going to have on your civilians. And because Israel proclaims itself to be a state of the Jews, Jakubowicz and I suppose Beinart to an extent are arguing, well, if that's the case, then you have to take into account the effect that your actions might repercuss on the Jews. But the distinction is that you don't blame the Jews collectively for what Israel is doing. You don't feed into the anti-Semitic fire, but you you use that as a part of your calculus as to whether an action is worthwhile or not. You know, and as for this particular war, it's hard to see so far what the I'm a retired journalist, but I don't want to go so far as to express an opinion, but it's hard to see so far.
No, go ahead, Ron. What the hell?
I don't understand the purpose of this war yet. I didn't understand it at the outset. I do understand why the Israelis, why it's so popular in Israel, because of the, I think that there's a just get it over and done with type of thing after 47 years of, you know, of living with a regime in the neighborhood that talks about wiping it about Israel. And we can go into whether or not that's serious or not. But the fact that that rhetoric exists, that that regime finances groups that have instigated actions against Israel, that have terrorized, especially on October 7th, have terrorized Israeli citizens, just like, just get it out of the way. Let's get this done. That's maybe an understandable response. It's not necessarily the rational response. And from a distance, you know, it's from a distance and not from a distance, because obviously I care deeply about Israel. I care deeply about my family that's there, and, you know, and their safety, and my friends that are there and their safety. And I know that they probably back this war, but I also know that I don't know what good it is doing them to rush into set shelters every night. You know, what good is it doing them to make those phone calls in the morning to make sure that the extended family's okay? You know, I'm not sure exactly what the outcome of this will be, other than more of the same for years to come.
Well, I assume what Netanyahu would say is a degraded Iranian state is good news. And I think he'd say that even if this leads to basically the dissolution of the Iranian state and chaos and maybe even civil war, that's better from his point of view than a strong and coherent, did I say Israeli? I meant Iranian, if I did.
Iranian,
anyway,
Iranian yeah.
state. So I guess that's his strategic position, it is said to be. It's less obvious, you know, how any of that is in America's interest, of course. Certainly, right. Including dissolution and civil war, but presumably that's, well, of course. Then there's his political motivation, and I think we don't talk enough about this in general with conflict between nations. You know, right. how it serves the political interests of actors. I'm sure Trump thought this was going to serve his. He thought it was going to be Venezuela and going to be really cool. So I don't know. I guess there's not that much point in speculating, but I assume that's what Israelis who support the war are kind of thinking, right? We're weakening Iran.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, I was a young adult again in 1982. I was 22. I was living, or 21, and I was living in Israel, and I hadn't been fully integrated. And when you're in that sort of situation, you tend to go with the flow. You want to be like the other people. And I was all for the Iran war. Sorry, the Lebanon war. I thought it was like, yes, the PLO has been bombing us for forever. They've been making lives miserable for the people up north. And I kind of willfully ignored certain anomalies, like there was actually a U.S. brokered ceasefire that was in place for 9 months before Ariel Sharon launched the Lebanon war. And so I'm not sure. In the end, like, the point of that was to try and transform Lebanon, and it actually led to chaos. It degraded the PLO. It absolutely degraded the PLO. You could even say that the degree to which it degraded the PLO, which was the initial enemy in the Lebanon war, helped set the stage for Oslo 10 years later. Okay. But it also created Hezbollah. It set up an 18-year occupation that was very corrosive to Israeli society, that was terrible for Lebanon. You know, we always have to take into account the effect that it has on civilian populations and enemy territory. And it just and made the, you know, now that people are still skeptical that whatever happens in Lebanon, maybe even if Hezbollah completely gets uprooted, that the Lebanese would want to make a peace with Israel. That wasn't the case in the 1970s. There was before Israel's occupation. Now Israel's like considered to be one of the, you know, I mean, for the Lebanese, you should talk to somebody Lebanese to get more insight. They're on an equivalence with Iran and Syria and other actors that have just made the Lebanese lives miserable for decades. So what did it produce, this degradation? And what, you know, and the same thing here. I don't think that the Iranian population is necessarily hostile towards Israel. Everybody says it's not, but I'm not sure what if that holds after, and the United States, you know, after this consistent bombardment, the horrifying deaths of 155 schoolgirls, that kind of thing, those things tend to linger.
Yeah, and in Lebanon, you know, Israel has now gone in again.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just seems increasingly like Bibi is just pursuing a kind of scorched earth policy. I mean, they've displaced what, like a million Lebanese or something? And for all we know, they will hang on to this territory. So it'll look to a lot of people like it was ethnic cleansing. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, of course, more than ever right now, there are pogroms going on kind of under the radar because there's so much else going on. And all of this feeds into the American, although most Americans are at best half aware of most of this stuff. The American elites who are agitating for change in relationship between the U.S. and Israel are very aware of this. They don't want to really be associated with any of it. And, you know, I don't want to get too much off on this tangent, but so Hezbollah responded to the killing of the Supreme Leader in Iran by firing, like, I don't know, 20 missiles at Israel. I didn't follow it that closely. It was kind of not that shocking, right? Not just because Hezbollah is an ally of Iran's, but because this guy was a religious figure. And Hezbollah's base is a Shia base. The Supreme Leader was a Shia religious figure. It seems to me there was a time when Israel used to respond to things like this, you know, maybe with disproportionate force, but not with overwhelmingly disproportionate. Like, right, they'd see if they could reestablish deterrence, you know? And it just seems like with Bibi, increasingly, you don't pause to see if you can do that, you know? Yeah. You just go all out.
He's you know, again, we don't want to mind read, but I think he's under the it's the psychological effect of having been asleep at the wheel on October the 7th. You know, He just wants to pound, pound, pound. He wants to do 180, having kind of, you know, in a backhanded way, nurtured Hamas until October the 7th. Now, you know, he doesn't want to be identified with that. He knows that election's coming up. He knows his rivals are going to make that an issue, and he wants to be the prime minister who actually does things and the consequences.
He's definitely done things. And that's the other thing is he had already done so much that everybody considered Iran to be in a very weak position. It's not like you realistically had to worry about Iran just out of the blue launching missiles at Israel. I mean, they're in an incredibly weak position. It will be for years to come because their allies in the, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah had been so degraded, but whatever. Here we are where we are. And what about, so this Joe Kent thing, what was your, I saw you did some tweeting about it and we can get into that, but what is your kind of take on that? And on the whole kind of, you know, MAGA, you know, rebellion against Trump, we shouldn't overstate it. It doesn't show up in a big way in the opinion polls, I think, but, you know, Tucker Carlson, even kind of Joe Rogan, this Joe Kent guy, Megyn Kelly and so on.
Yeah, I think regarding the MAGA thing, I know, like, your Rosenberg has written for The Atlantic, and Harry Enten has talked about this on CNN, that there is just continuous 100% identification of MAGA with Trump. But, you know, the flip side of that is, to what degree is MAGA just being for Trump? If you might have been MAGA until you go, like, you know, let's say you could have Marjorie Taylor Greene as the emblem of this. You might have been MAGA until you were disillusioned with Trump, and then you're no longer MAGA. So if somebody, a pollster calls you and says, are you MAGA? You're going to say no. But the real question is, how MAGA were you until this war? So I don't know. I don't think that the rift so far is in the MAGA elites or the formerly MAGA elites or the nationalist conservative elites. Maybe it hasn't trickled down so far. I do know that this is, you know, we see in polling how badly this is affecting Trump among independents, the inflation, the rising price of gasoline. It's that those kinds of things can't be doing good things for him. You know, as for Joe Kent, my reactions is that this guy, you know, he had associations with white nationalists. He kind of, you know, gave what I thought were less than credible explanations that he didn't know somebody like Nick Fuentes was. And, but more specifically, he blamed the Iraq and then the ensuing violence in Syria on Israel. And I went through the whole 2000s explaining why that was nonsense. That not on Israel, just on Israel, but on the pro-Israel community. And I think, you know, this what I identified, what I knew then, and what I've remembered now about that whole thing is that the Bush administration, less so than the Trump administration, but the Bush administration was very much fueled by loyalty. If you wanted an audience there, if you wanted to get your agenda done, whatever you were, if you wanted access, you needed to be on board, especially with the Iraq war. And that was true of the, you know, a lot of Democrats in Congress. It famously tanked Hillary's 2008 run, the fact that she was on the side of the Iraq war. It was true of the media. There were consequences there. Howell Raines eventually left the New York Times because of his boosterism for the Iraq war. And then you have, you had the Jewish community. You had like the organized Jewish community saying things in favor of the Iraq war. But if you dug down, I think there was basically one organization that was gung-ho for the Iraq war. That was the American Jewish Committee, and wasn't even AIPAC. AIPAC wasn't that enthusiastic. And the whole fund, you know, in terms of the famous Walton Meersharm chapter in their book about the Israel lobby, they were plucking quotes out of context that could have been ascribed to anybody who wanted to be in favor of something that seemed to be like the thing to go with in the early 2000s. It's not a profile in courage. It's that it's really... reflect, and there were among some Jewish leaders, particularly in the Reform Jewish movement, like some introspection afterwards. Why did we let ourselves get dragged into it? But that's the thing. It's a matter of getting dragged into it. And so 20 years later, if you're Joe Kent and you're saying that the pro-Israel community in Israel were the spurs to the Iraq war, when really it was about Israel, you know, in terms of its government, quietly advising against taking the Iraq war too far in publicly being supportive because Israel was, you know, the U.S. was Israel's closest ally. If you say that they're the ones who, why, you know, you have to ask, like, why isn't he saying Hillary Clinton is the principal cause of the Iraq war? That, George W. Bush would not have gone to war without Hillary Clinton saying she wanted to go to war, because it would be an absurd proposition to say so. Why didn't he saying that the New York Times editorial page was the cause of the Iraq war? I mean, there are people who will say that, but they will be rightly consigned to the conspiracy theory bins of history. Then, so if you're going to pluck these statements out of history, if you're not going to look at the broader context, yes, it's very telling that an individual would say that the principal driver, that the lone driver to the Iraq war, was Israel. And the difference between then and now is that it's actually, obviously, with the Iraq war, it's easier to make that argument because it's so patently absurd. If you looked at what went on and how George W. Bush went to war and why he went to war, to sort of suddenly outsource it to Israel or to the pro-Israel community or to the Jewish community. Now it's different because, of course, Israel did want to go to war with Iran. And it becomes a more subtle thing. So I think with Joe Kent putting in the Iraq war, it was a big tell that this guy is far right, that he leans into conspiracy theories, that he's susceptible to conspiracy theories having to do with Jews and with Israel. That's the Iraq war. The Iran war, it's a difficult... It's a more nuanced thing to tease out whether somebody picks on Netanyahu, because Netanyahu really did lobby for this war. Netanyahu really did want this war. And so then it becomes more of are you saying, as he said in his letter, that Netanyahu and Israel are the only reasons that that Trump has gone to war? And I think that is absurd. That's like another tell, but it's a more subtle tell to notice, because certainly they were part of the reason that Israel's government is part of the reason that this war is happening. But, you know, so as somebody who's, you know, cares about the Jewish community, cares about the consequences, is very worried when somebody drives a truck into a preschool in suburban Detroit and worries about how rhetoric affects that. You know, I think that's my primary concern in pointing these things out. But also it's so grossly simple that you're not addressing the actual reasons. There's the panoply of reasons for the war, chief among them having to do with Trump and how he functions and how he wants to be the president who has dared to do the things that other presidents wouldn't do, and how he wants to be the president that makes the world bow before America, you know.
And solves the Middle East problem once and for all, which he probably thought he was going to do. I mean, honestly, that's how far from reality I think he is. Let me read what Joe Kent said. He said, "I cannot in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran. Iran pose no imminent threat to our nation, and it is clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby. And then in deeper in the letter, he refers to the Iraq war as a war manufactured by Israel. That's putting it pretty strongly, even more strongly than some people who would underscore the influence of the pro-Israel community and some people in Israel. Of course, Bibi Netanyahu himself famously, now he wasn't prime minister at the moment. Who was prime minister in
Sharon.
Okay. But Bibi is, you know, he was on camera assuring Congress that everything would go great once we deposed Saddam. But anyway, let me ask you this. Is it your view that it seems safe to say, I gather, correct me if I'm wrong, that you think that talking like this can foment anti-Semitism? Do you think it is in and of itself evidence of anti-Semitism to talk like this, to say that Israel got us into the war with Iraq in 2003, or to put it a little more diffusely and say, you know, pro-Israel, influential pro-Israel actors got us into war with Iraq. Is that, in your view, itself, as somebody like, I assume, Barry Weiss would say, I mean, it is, a number of people would say this, that that is in and of itself anti-Semitic. Well, the Anti-Defamation League would almost certainly say it, I guess.
Yeah, certainly now it would say it. Maybe then it would say it as well. And I remember at the time, writing about Walton Mearsheimer's book, I didn't want to qualify them as anti-Semitic. I didn't want to call them that. And I still don't want to call them that. I don't necessarily think that Joe Kent is anti-Semitic. What it is it's evidence of living in a community where anti-Semitic myth and tropes are available to you, are more proliferate more than you would in certain other intellectual communities. So they're less guardrails to taking them. For me, anti-Semitism is like, you know, should be considered like a full-time job, you know. Nick Fuentes, Richard Spencer, they're anti-Semites. For the rest of us, and I think that, you know, this is true for racism and misogyny as well. I mean, we're susceptible to certain tropes because we grew up in a culture that has these tropes available. It's just a matter of being on guard amongst ourselves, separate them. I may have mentioned this in the past before, but I think like for gender-based bias, there's a useful distinction between sexism and misogyny. Misogyny is, like I said, it's a full-time job. You know, you really have to hate women all the time to be a misogynist. It has to be reflexive. Sexism is where you're susceptible to certain cliches and bigotries about women without realizing it. And once you're made aware of it, you say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was doing that. And then you might or might not divest yourself of that sexist belief. It's not as toxic. And I wish that there were similar distinctions for racism and for anti-Semitism, because I think that it's useful to understand. So yeah, I would say that, you know, Joe Kent lives in that community. He might not be aware of how those tropes play. It's very easy. You want to, when you have like easy and available explanations as to why things are bad, it's very seductive to buy into them. It doesn't necessarily mean that Joe Kent goes around avoiding such and such a restaurant because it's owned by Jews or something like that. There are people like that, but it doesn't mean he's like that.
Yeah, I definitely want to follow up on what you just said about the bounds of speech, because I think that enters into all of this in a second way that I want to talk about. In fact, maybe I'll get to that now, and then I'll get to what I think Joe Kent might say in defending his claim that pro-Israel actors played a big role in getting us into the Iraq War. I haven't looked deeply at that issue, but I'm fairly conversant, I think, in the arguments on both sides. The speech thing is that I think, you know, speech policing can boomerang. And I thought of this, I was looking at a tweet of yours, and you were talking about the connection between kind of Trump's attack on wokeness in the realm of generic racism and misogyny, and the anti-Semitism issue. And what you wrote is Trump shattered taboos against racism and misogyny that had accrued post-World War II when he was explicitly racist and misogynist and won, meaning I think he successfully shattered the taboos. To the degree he was anti-Semitic, then it was insinuative. But Jews were never going to be siloed once these taboos could be handily shelved. So, in other words, you know, once the taboos against other kinds of racism fell under Trump's influence and under the influence of the whole attack on wokeness, that eventually it was gonna reach the realm of anti-Semitism and Jews. What I thought is there's another dynamic that I think is parallel here, and this is one thing that makes the issue so complicated, which is that to some extent, I think the true racism and misogyny, and I think there was way too much fuzziness, as I believe you do, about, or not enough fuzziness. There was too stark and broad a definition of what constituted misogyny and racism. I believe, too black and white a conception of it, and maybe too broad a conception of it. You can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but I think that, and I think the attempt to enforce that speech code that defined racism very broadly and misogyny very broadly increased the amount of racism and misogyny. It was like, you know, I remember like 25 or 30 years ago, my wife and sister-in-law, I think, were asking me and my brother-in-law, like, what is the deal with Howard Stern, you know, the shock jock in New York? Like, what is the source of his appeal? And neither me nor my brother-in-law was a particular fan. I didn't listen to him. But I said, well, I think a lot of it is just there are so many things that you're not allowed to say that are arguably true, you know, maybe about differences between men and women or something or whatever, that people want to go to a place where this guy says them, and it's like a release. And I think then you carry that impulse far enough, and you become an actual misogynist. You become an actual racist in reaction against a speech code you find oppressive. And I think the same dynamic I think works with anti-Semitism. I don't know if you've heard Nick Fuentes's own autobiographical origin story. I don't know if you listened to his conversation with Tucker, but what he says is he started out, I don't know if it's true, but a dynamic like this can happen, I think. He says he started out asking innocent questions about why we give so much money to Israel. And then the blowback he got from, what's the name of the guy? Ben Shapiro. There you go. Good call. Right. The blowback, you know, Ben Shapiro just tried to shut him down. Like, you are an anti-Semite, according to Nick Fuentes. I don't know what actually happened, but I do know, you know, that people can react in the way you were trying to avoid reacting when you said, I'm not ready to call Joe Ken an anti-Semite. And I think the speech code itself boomerangs in that way. And I think it's done it in all of these realms to some extent. And I think, like, for example, the ADL's attempt, in my view, to enforce a pretty narrow speech code. And I've personally been, you know, I've had the head of the ACLU say unkind things about, you know, I wrote a piece in The Intercept about how coverage of Iran was making war with Iran more likely, because the coverage, I was looking at a New York Times piece, like, didn't look at Iran's strategic point of view and how some things that we consider offensive, it considers defensive. It considers some of these, you know, and this is just a super common dynamic in war, right? I mean, Israel considers the attack on Iran defensive. They really do. Yeah, nobody in Iran's going to believe that, but Israel really does. So that was what the thing was about. And I did call attention to the fact this New York Times piece is quoting people from Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which, as you know, is an ardently pro-Israel, anti-Iran group. And so Greenblatt says this piece is, you know, the head of the ADL, says this piece is, you know, like an 8-tweet thread or something. This piece is at best illogical and at worst biased. Okay. Now, when the head of the ADL says you may be biased, I think we know what kind of bias he's trying to insinuate, right? Mm-hmm. He's not saying I support Jim Crow laws in the South, okay? And, you know, it's like, and I had not mentioned an ethnic group in the piece, okay? And as you can tell, that really pisses me off. It really pisses me off. Now, I didn't go to Nick Fuentes levels, but I'm telling you, it's going to happen, right? If you try that hard to crack down on genuinely earnest, you know, attempts at analysis and interrogation. And so this is the problem I think we have, is that, you know, you've got, I think, a growing or at least increasingly conspicuous and evident anti-Semitism, or increasingly intense or something. But certain kinds of attempts to do something about it exacerbate it. Okay.
I understand that argument. I don't entirely agree with it. I think it underestimates the degree to which maybe we can rise above ourselves. I mean, I think a good example is, I think, a guy you had on recently, Matt Duss, who's constantly targeted with this bullshit. Like, he's, you know, he's an anti-Semite, and he's a good friend of mine too. And,
We should be clear. You meant to put quotes around "he's an anti-Semite." That's the allegation.
Right, but we
don't want somebody to clip the part where you say he's an anti-Semite and he's a very good friend of mine.
And so he manages to keep his head above this at all times, and maybe that's just superhuman, you know. And he points out, like, he's consistently pointing out now. He points out that there's no, you know, that. He points out that there's no Israeli complicity in the Iraq war, and that the primary responsibility for the Iran war from a U.S. perspective lies with Donald Trump. And I know that he gets these stupid attacks all the time, and he endures them, but he manages to still think for himself without being reactive. You know, and my hope is that everybody could be like that. I don't know if it's superhuman or not, but I think that is, you know, and that's what I try to, is the same thing here, you know, just for being like, you know, a Jew who's identified with Israel, you could call me a Zionist. I fit the classic definition of Zionist. Because of that, I get all sorts of, you know, attacks from pro-Palestinians, from people on the left, you know, calling me, and people like me, baby killers, this and that. And it's water off my back. I mean, you know, they're stupid people. What am I going to do? And I think that I understand, you know, it's water off my back. They're stupid people because these people are not that important. When it's coming from Jonathan Greenblatt, I understand how that can be a little more intimidating and scary if you're getting that kind of attack. And I wish
less and less, honestly. I mean, go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, I just, you know, his predecessor, Abe Foxman, is like, I know that he rankled people for some reasons, but he wouldn't. He tweets funny, like overly long old man tweets, Abe, but he's still a very smart guy, and he wouldn't say, you know, he wouldn't go out for the soundbite. He'd get you on the phone, you'd have a long conversation with him, he'd try to tease it out, he'd try to work out, he'd try to see your point of view. You know, Jonathan famously said, I forget, like anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, period, or no difference or something. I think he said period. And
yeah,
Foxman is not a guy who would say anything, period. He would say, well, let's look at this. Let's examine examples where anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism and but I don't think that necessarily, I understand it gets you on TV. I understand it gets you attention, but I don't think it necessarily serves the discourse very usefully.
Yeah, I don't even think Greenblatt is serving the ADL at this point, because I really think he's, you know, you've got now mainstream establishment progressive figures like Tommy Vitor just screaming at him on Twitter and saying, you know, cut it out. Israel did, the New York Times itself is reporting that Israel played a big role in getting us into the Iran war, whatever the Vitor tweet was exactly. But, to me, it's easier and easier to dismiss, ADL's, disdain. But, is there anything else you want to say about that? I mean, let me get clearer. You're saying on my basic argument that speech codes boomerang. Like, you need speech codes. That's the problem. I mean, all societies have speech codes. Notwithstanding the claims of, I guess I would call them free speech absolutists or something, I don't think there are any examples of functioning, healthy societies that had no taboos at all, that had no kind of punitive sanctions, enforcing norms.
Right.
Informal sanctions, not prison, but you know, you don't get invited to certain parties if you say certain things.
Right.
And but do you buy the argument that there is also this boomerang effect, and that is one thing that does energize the bigotry that some sort of speech code is needed to address?
I mean, I think it spurs anger. Again, I don't think that it would necessarily make people say, okay, we can do those things. I mean, there's a famous case here, like, that really affected a lot of people badly, that the Washington Post, when it was a good introspective paper, covered. Its cartoonist at the time, Tom Tolles, had a Halloween party, I think. Mm-hmm. And Megyn Kelly had said that there's nothing wrong with putting on blackface. And a woman arrived as Megyn Kelly in blackface, and she was hounded out of the party. And the two women who hounded her out of the party, they proceeded to sort of then go on a campaign of blaming Tom Tolles for having these kinds of friends. They were also angry at Tom Tolles because he would not tell them the name of the woman she was fired from her job because she was eventually exposed. I mean, the two women who were behind that, I really disliked them. I came away from that thinking, these people are nuts. You know, why are they, you know, Tom Tolles, eventually a great cartoonist. I think this helped, you know, bring about his retirement from the Washington Post, this stupid scandal that shouldn't have been a scandal. This woman's life was ruined. But that doesn't make, at no time did I ever think, and, you know, blackface is good. I didn't get to that point. I mean, that, you know, I'm an example of one, but I didn't think that, on the other hand, you know, it's okay to have blackface. I just think that this kind of opprobrium can be, you know, quote unquote woke, gone wild and gone bad. It doesn't mean that we should examine why blackface is so horrific. This woman made a mistake. I think she did make a mistake by turning up in blackface, because it was asking people to understand the irony a little too deeply. But you just tell her to go, why don't you remove the blackface and come back to the party? Everything's fine. That's what that's what you do in a normative society. You don't have to ruin her life.
So I had forgotten that she was kind of satirizing Megyn Kelly. So it was actually a critique, a comment from the ideological perspective of the people who then hounded the woman out of polite society. I remember the incident. Yeah, things like that. They blow back. I think so. Listen, as you know, on this podcast, what we generally do is we talk for a while in public, and then we go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. I encourage everyone to become one so that courageous independent media can thrive. Right, Ron? You're nodding your head.
Yeah, no, I agree. I, too, have a Substack.
I failed to plug your Substack. Talk about it. That's what we'll do for several minutes before we go into overtime.
Oh, no, it's just, it's a Substack in which I started it because I wanted to write more at length. I wanted to have more personalized analysis than I could when I was a bureau chief at the wire service. I think my first piece was about this whole proposition that Palestinians be expelled from Gaza, and had anybody actually thought that through at the time? That seems to have tapered off. That's abated, that whole thing, thank God. But, and then, you know, and also, like, I write poetry, so it allows me to put up my poetry to my poor beleaguered subscribers. And then,
do you make them pay for that, or do you pay them to read it, or what?
I send them chocolates. And then, people were still leaking stuff to me after I left JTA. So I broke a few stories there. And mm-hmm. And it's just a useful outlet for that. If I think I can write about something well, I mean, you know, I haven't written a lot about this war because or barely anything because so much else is being written that I think is fine. You know, I don't need to necessarily weigh in on it. But when I think that there, particularly if there's something that I remember that maybe other people don't remember, I will write about that. I remember. You know, in terms, I didn't realize I had a long memory until 2003, when I think it was 2003 or 2004 when Saddam was captured. And, you know, JTA always has the Jewish or Israeli angle. We want to know what the story is. And so I thought that the editors in New York must have known what I'd known and overlooked it. And the next day I said, well, you know, the other angle is that Ehud Barak mounted this spectacularly failed operation in 1995 to kill Saddam Hussein. And everybody was like, what? And then the editor got on the phone with me afterwards and she said, you have to tell us those things in real time. And I said, I thought everybody knew. You know, it was like, it was a big story in Israel. I think that's this thing. It was a big story in Israel at the time, but maybe not around.
I hadn't realized that actually.
There was a famous, an accident at an artillery range called Selim.
Accident is in quotes?
No, it was an accident. There was some. It made headlines because you cannot hide in Israel. You can't hide the deaths of soldiers. And what happened was a friendly fire accident during a training mm-hmm. exercise. And so the Israeli military tried to say it was a routine training exercise, but Haaretz found a way to get past the censor and make clear that no, this was a high profile training exercise because the military chief of staff or the deputy military chief of staff at the time was present, and they managed to get people to be aware of that. And so then the questions were, well, what were they doing? What was this training exercise do? So the story that initially came out that was leaked and was that they were trying to kill Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah,
right?
Which is like, you know, it's an operation that is kind of bold, but it wouldn't be surprising for Israel to have done at the time. And then a few weeks later, a journalist with better sources actually got it out, and this was eventually confirmed that it was an attempt to kill Saddam Hussein because Israel hadn't responded during the first Gulf War to 39 Scud missiles, and there was a sense that Israel had lost its deterrence, and so the way to regain that deterrence was to kill Saddam Hussein. And so it never even got to the operational stage because of the terrible accident at Selim, but. Yeah, so yeah, I knew that. So in any case, that guides my. Now that I'm, I think when you're in day-to-day journalism, you're like you're forced to repeat what other people are doing because sometimes there isn't anything more to be said about a story, but you have to write the story nonetheless.
And you forget how much time has passed. You know, like even the Iraq War, like there's a lot of people who are now known like commentators who were like maybe 11 when that happened or
yes,
something.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, honestly, it's been 23 years.
Right.
And and you forget that, you know. But God knows my memory goes back further than that, to the extent that it still functions. So anyway, in overtime, we're going to plumb the depths of your knowledge and memory further, maybe. And I want to talk about about just the state of the war, what you're hearing about how maybe Israel is so deeply penetrated Iran intelligence wise. And I do want to get around, and maybe I'll do this first, to what I think people like Joe Kent would say about. And trying to defend the claim that pro-Israel actors played a big role in getting America into the Iraq War. But first, I want to say that your Substack is called Ron's Substack. And it has pieces with such headlines as J.D. Vance and Tim Walz, Who Wore the Holocaust Worst? And one called I Am So Fucking Tired. Now, that was in reaction to the Michigan thing you alluded to, the truck, right. The attempt. The unsuccessful attempt to kill Jews, that came out after I had Peter on. So Peter had done his thing about how Netanyahu's policies were fomenting anti-Semitism in response to that guy who shouted at a congressional hearing or something, nobody wants to fight for Israel, whatever. And he was a former, I think, retired Marine, maybe. He was in uniform. That had triggered it. So this came after Peter did that thing. But this was a guy whose, I guess, nieces and or nephews had been killed in Lebanon very recently by the Israeli military action that's ongoing there. And so I assume Peter would have said, this is Exhibit B. I don't know. Of course, obviously, Peter would also say this does not absolve the guy for moral responsibility for what he did. But you should still, I think he would say, keep in mind the possible or even likely consequences of your policies. I think that's what he'd say. So anyway, I again encourage people to click on the link in the show notes or just go to nonzero.org, where you will see this post, and that's, you can just click on that and sign up to become a paid subscriber that way. So thanks to everyone who has followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime